You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, April the 6th. We are going to talk this hour with Tom DeLay. You know him as the House Majority Leader until he stepped down under a cloud of alleged campaign finance violations. He has a new book out, perhaps appropriately titled, No Retreat, No Surrender, One American's Fight. And we will welcome your questions and comments for Tom DeLay, who will talk about his career and Washington and what he thinks must be done to save the conservative movement. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Tom DeLay was first elected to the House of Representatives from Texas in 1984. He became Deputy Minority Whip in 1988, Majority Whip in 1995, and Majority Leader in 2003. Since leaving Congress in 2006, he has launched the Grassroots Action and Information Network, as well as a popular political blog, TomDeLay.com. He is the author of No Retreat, No Surrender, One American's Fight. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
I appreciate your time and being with us. It's nice to talk to you. We have talked about you in the past on this program.
No kidding.
Yes, and I'm sure you want to address some of the things that were said. I know that you do in your book. I'm looking at the chapter here where you talk about the lies that liberals told about me. But I one of the guests we talked to was the author of, I think the book was called The Hammer. It was probably an unauthorized biography of you.
I would imagine.
Where did you get that name, The Hammer?
Well, actually, it was given to me by the Washington Post. It was a disparaging nickname. Obviously, they weren't trying to make me look good. They couldn't believe that we could be as effective in passing all the legislation that we were passing without breaking people's legs and arms and bribing people to vote against their conscience and their district. It doesn't fit because they didn't take the time to look into what I write in the book of how I redesigned the whip operation in what I call grow the vote. I came in and organized members of Congress into whips. The whole idea was to get in early on a piece of legislation, usually right when it's introduced, and work with our members, try to figure out what their problems are, and try to take care of those problems as the bill moves through the process, with the idea that when the bill reaches the floor of the House, they would want to vote for it because they had a part to play in it. Mm-hmm. And that worked for us. Well, I was whip for almost 8 years, and we never lost a vote. So,
yeah, you prefer a more positive spin on the hammer that another colleague mentioned, that the hammer was for building something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody says a hammer is for building, it's not for for building things, not tearing things down. So, but yeah, but I've had to live through that, through the whole Republican majority of people trying to twist and make look ugly what we were doing because they didn't agree with the things we were doing and the bills we were passing.
Yeah, let's talk some about the chapter I mentioned about the we'll talk about some of the 10 lies that liberals have told about me. You say that lie number one is that Tom DeLay took trips illegally paid for by corporations and lobbyists, which he rewarded with political favors. Why is that untrue or a lie?
Well, because it's untrue, and therefore it's a lie, and it's been the lie has been perpetrated with no evidence whatsoever to the contrary. To prove their position, there is absolutely no evidence that lobbyists paid for my trips because they didn't. I traveled not extensively, but I did travel around the world on issues. I I traveled in Russia and Soviet Union, helping persecuted Jews get out of the Soviet Union. I've been very supportive of the Marianas Islands. I've been very supportive of Taiwan and its struggle with Red China. I've been very supportive of South Korea. I've worked for the conservative movement in Europe. I love golf. I play golf when I can. And if you go on a trip for 7 days or 7 to 10 days, if you find an afternoon free, I go and play golf.
Yeah.
Not paid for by lobbyists.
Yeah, who paid for that trip to Scotland where we heard you played golf?
I forget the name of the foundation, but it's a foundation, a legitimate conservative foundation that for like 15 to 20 years paid for trips overseas for conservatives.
We're going to check our weather forecast and then continue talking with Tom DeLay about his book, No Retreat, No Surrender, One American's Fight. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Please join us if you have a question about the time that Tom DeLay spent in Congress, or if you want to ask him about the conservative movement and his efforts along those lines as well. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 17 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday morning, April the 6th. We are talking with Tom DeLay, author of No Retreat, No Surrender, talking about his book, his career in Washington, and also what he thinks must be done to save the conservative movement. And we welcome your questions for him, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'll also get some of Mr. DeLay's comments on current issues in the news as well, but wanted to touch on a few of comments in this book, the chapter that the top 10 lies that liberals have told about Tom DeLay. Line number two, Mr. DeLay, that you introduced a culture of corruption into Washington through the K Street Project.
Yeah.
Yeah. And why is that? Why is that a lie?
Well, if we're going to go lie by lie, and I'm more than willing to do that, I need to give you the big picture of what was going on here. I went through 11 years of attacks by the left. Actually, 11 years ago, Patrick Kennedy, a congressman from Rhode Island, announced and raised money his announcement that he was going to demonize me and take me out. I went through 11 years of frivolous ethics charges, many of them in the book that we're talking about, all of them dismissed by a bipartisan ethics committee. I even had a RICO suit, a racketeering suit brought by Patrick Kennedy, that was dismissed within 6 months as frivolous. And now I'm indicted under an indictment on laws in Texas that don't even exist. This was an 11-year attempt to disparage my name, ruin my reputation, and I call it the new wave of election politics, the criminalization of politics. It's no longer good enough just to defeat somebody publicly or politically or vilify them publicly. They have to now carpet bomb you to disgrace you, bankrupt you, ruin your family, and try to send you to jail in order to gain power and maintain that power.
Yeah.
So.
There was an indictment for campaign finance violations.
Well, yes, on an accounting procedure. This district attorney, who has a long history of using the Texas justice system to destroy his political enemies, both Democrat and Republican. I mean, he did exactly the same thing to now sitting Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, where he drug her name through the mud for 2 or 3 years. Indicted her, went to court, finally went to court, and wouldn't even present his case, and it was thrown out of court. But the damage had been done, and that's the way they operate. The same thing here. He went through 6 grand juries before he found one the day before the statute of limitations ran out, and this grand jury, the last one, had just been sworn in, hadn't even been through orientation, And he got two indictments against me on an accounting procedure. They call it money laundering, but there's no such law in Texas of money laundering to violate the election code, nor is there a law of conspiracy to violate the election code. So I was actually indicted on laws that don't exist.
Yeah, and what is the status of that indictment?
It's been going on longer than the Iraq War. This has been going on since 2002. I was indicted in 2005. I've been trying to get to court ever since. Every time we win a motion in the district court, this DA appeals it, and that takes a year to 2 years in that appeals process. So I'm in the appeals court, the Texas Supreme Court of Criminal Appeals, and waiting for a ruling. And it's been in that court for well over a year now.
And was it that indictment that, because of the House rules, forced you to step down as majority leader?
That's exactly right. It wasn't the House rules. The Republicans have a rule that says if you're indicted as a leader, you have to step down temporarily. The Democrats don't have such a rule, but they use the Republican rules against them. If we'd have modified that rule, which we some members tried to do, where they basically said we're going to pick our leaders and we're going to look at this, and if it's political prosecution, then we're going to waive the rule. If they'd have done that, I believe I'd have never been indicted.
Yeah.
All they wanted is the indictment to force me to step aside.
Yeah, and I'm not going to go through all 10 lies, but I did want to get you to, justify the K Street Project. Why did the country need that?
Actually, I'm proud of the K Street Project. When we came in 1995, the first Republican majority in 40 years, the culture of Washington, D.C. was pro-Democrat, and we wanted to change the culture. K Street is where all the lobbyists office, and by and large, when we took over in 1995, most of the lobbyists in Washington, by large margin, were Democrat lobbyists. If you were a owner of a company or a union leader or a leader of a trade association or whatever and wanted to hire a lobbyist, you would, during the 40 years of Democrat domination, you would hire a Democrat that would, because they had access to the people in power, the Democrats. When we came in, these lobbyists, their power and their money comes from knowing the people in power. So it was quite obvious right from the get-go that they would work very hard to get us out of the majority. And we felt very strongly that our friends, people we know, should be who we are working with. And we encourage people to hire, if they're going to hire lobbyists, to hire people that we know and the people that would support us and support our agenda. And then, actually, over the last 12 years, that's what's been happening, is more and more Republicans that support the Republican agenda were hired by K Street.
Yeah. But
nothing illegal, by the way.
Yeah. We have a number of callers, so I think I'll go to the phones. Rita in Wauwatosa, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. As I'm listening to this, I'm wondering where this getcha politics began. It didn't begin when the Republicans got in, and I watched as they decimated a family as they were trying to get a hold of Clinton. They beat, and maybe some of that beating that they did had its ramifications long term. So where did this begin? I want to know, did it really begin just in 1995? When did it begin?
I guess you're talking about the criminalization of politics?
Yes.
I guess that is in the eyes of the beholder, when it began. Some people believe it began back when Newt Gingrich took on Jim Wright. But Newt Gingrich did not file charges. There's a difference between the politics of personal destruction and actually filing charges that cause you to hire lawyers that put you in jeopardy of going to jail. That's the difference I'm talking about. I'm not justifying the politics of personal destruction because it did go on. Now, I don't think it's criminalization of politics to hold the President of the United States accountable for lying to a grand jury and committing perjury. It is the responsibility of the Congress to hold the President responsible. But what I'm talking about are lies and false charges and frivolous charges that never get to trial or they're dismissed because they are so frivolous and have no basis in fact. And the whole reason of doing it is to disgrace people and ruin people's reputation and undermine our justice system.
Let's go next to Bob in Verona. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Mr. DeLay, I just heard you mention something about Congress holding the president responsible. Recently, I was kind of surprised when the president jumped all over Nancy Pelosi for going to Syria and then said nothing about other Republicans that went there as well. And I guess I'd also like to know if you feel strongly about the oversight responsibility of Congress and also including foreign relations.
Well, absolutely, and there's not, in my opinion, there's nothing wrong with members going over into an area like the Middle East and learning what's going on there. It's a very different matter to go over there and think you're going to negotiate and present the foreign policy of the United States. That's a big difference in my mind. I just assume no member of Congress go to Syria because it's a terrorist state, and we should not be giving Assad, the dictator of Syria, any sort of standing in the world by being visited by any member of Congress. But in my opinion, for Nancy Pelosi to go as the third-ranking constitutional officer of the United States and negotiate, as she pointed out, she was negotiating on bringing messages that were ultimately false to a terrorist state, is incredibly dangerous. It undermines our foreign policy. It sends confusing messages to our friends, and it certainly emboldens our enemies and, frankly, puts our soldiers in even more dangerous situations because it emboldens our enemies.
We're going to check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll talk about other current issues with Tom DeLay and welcome more questions for him. He is the former House Majority Leader. He is the author of a new book, No Retreat, No Surrender, One American's Fight. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 7:36 on this Friday, April the 6th, and we are talking with Tom DeLay this hour. He was first elected to the House of Representatives from Texas in 1984. He served as Majority Leader, was appointed Majority Leader in 2006. Since leaving Congress in 2006, he has been working on a number of things, including his blog, TomDeLay.com. He is the author of a new book, No Retreat, No Surrender, One American's Fight. And our next caller is Bernie in Elkhorn. Hi, Bernie. You're on the air.
Good morning to you both. I think that the term conservative, as used, say, by the American Conservative magazine, gets misused by a lot of elected Republicans. I would say that conservatism, in its true sense, implies fiscal responsibility, and it implies less government interference with people's personal liberties. And I'll cite a couple examples to get your reflection. I would say that the drug war, for example, is not only exceedingly costly to the taxpayers, but is an infringement on liberty. I would say that the military spending, which folks like Chalmers Johnson have documented to be upwards, you know, up to around $750 billion a year, is completely unrelated to defense and is a complete waste of taxpayer dollars. You know, if we mean seriousness about defense, we should close the border with Mexico and bring the troops home. How do you look at these things, Tom?
Well, thanks for the question. I think we can deal with semantics all day long, but I think what you're talking about is the difference between libertarianism and conservatism. I am not a libertarian, although I have libertarian tendencies. I do believe that society is undermined and torn apart because of the drug culture, and we as a society should not support the use of drugs. And I certainly don't agree with your assessment of military. Conservative, the most important tenet of being a conservative is a strong national defense with a strong military, and the old Ronald Reagan adage, peace through strength. So, I lay out in my book what I think the conservative movement is, and I welcome anybody to have that debate with us. I lay out a manifesto, and I suggest in the book an agenda to fight for the future. The conservative movement needs to have this debate we're in right now to determine who we are and where we want to take the country in the future.
Yeah. Where do you want to take the country in the future?
Well, my agenda that I suggest in the book is pretty simple. It's a 5-point agenda. Win the war on terror, which includes border security and homeland security. Redefine government based on constitutional principles, and the gentleman just called is talking about some of that. Completely scrap the federal tax code and replace it with a national sales tax. Hold the judiciary accountable. And win the war against our culture, end abortion as we know it, and others issues. That's an agenda. That's a conservative agenda that conservatives can rally around and push for the future.
Yeah. Why do you say in the book that President Bush may be compassionate, but he is no conservative?
Well, he himself calls him a compassionate conservative. I was trying to tell the story of the history of the Republican majority, and part of that history is the Bush administration. And like the last caller, I didn't agree with the president on No Child Left Behind. I believe we ought to get the federal government out of the business of education. Education belongs on the local level and no more than the state levels. Our parents should develop education for our children, not some federal bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. But the president tripled the size of spending in education. So, you know, it's a matter of degrees. The president's probably not as conservative as I am, but he's certainly more conservative than Al Gore or John Kerry.
What about the Medicare Part D bill? What did you think of that?
Well, I'm very proud of it. You know, even though we didn't have the votes to eliminate some of these welfare programs, we did have the votes to apply conservative principles to some of these welfare state programs. In welfare reform, we actually expanded government in order to get people off of welfare. And now today, millions of people are off of welfare.
Oh, no, I meant the prescription drug benefit.
I know, but mm-hmm. my point is if you apply the same mm-hmm. Criteria to Medicare as welfare reform, we'd have never gotten welfare reform. We applied conservative principles to the Medicare system. We saw this system that was created way before we had pharmaceuticals was not serving senior citizens. And it would pay $40,000 to amputate feet because of diabetes, but it wouldn't pay $100 a month for glucophage to save those feet. It just didn't make sense. So we came in and we applied conservative principles. We applied choice, competition, bringing in the private sector. We put in health savings accounts, which I think is the right reform for health care for seniors in the future. We even instituted some ideas like preventive medicine, an incredible concept of when you sign up for Medicare, you have to actually get a physical and have a prevention plan designed just for you. Those kinds of things where we can have a healthcare system that fits seniors and brings in choice and competition to lower prices is actually working. We're saving millions upon millions of dollars in the Medicare system today.
But the way that that bill passed did raise eyebrows in that a vote that should normally take about 15 minutes or so was kept open for hours, 3 hours or more. It was the vote happened in the wee hours of the morning. Lots of talk about arms being twisted, almost broken to sway votes. That's not the way to pass this kind of legislation, is it?
Well, a lot of people think that the 15-minute vote on a bill is like a football game. When the clock runs out, the vote is over. That's not the case. The vote is over when the majority and when the speaker says it's over. You are working with your members. You're not breaking arms or anything like that. You're working with your members during a very controversial vote. The Democrats had their members that wanted to vote for this bill waiting until the Republicans put up the majority of votes, and we needed two votes, and we worked with our members. There was no, I mean, the leaders did not threaten members or anything like that, but you debate with them. You try to convince them that the voting for the bill is the right way to do it. It did take 3 hours. That's unfortunate. But the outcome is a better health care system for senior citizens. And I think that's important.
Daniel in Rice Lake is our next caller. Hello, Daniel.
Hello. In 2002, polls showed Americans were divided evenly, Republicans versus Democrats, 50-50. In a recent poll, 65% said they were Democrats, only 35% Republicans. The next election will be even more damaging to the GOP because of the disastrous war in Iraq. In hindsight, would you again support the invasion of Iraq?
Absolutely. The Iraq is just one battlefield of the overall war on terror. We are at war. We have been at war for many, many years and just didn't know it. We've been attacked left and right by these Islamo-fascists. We have to fight this war. Unfortunately, Democrats have no alternative to winning the war on terror other than surrender and appeasement. And that will not stop the terrorists. It didn't stop it in the past. It didn't stop the terrorists in the past. And I agree with the president, respecting for his leadership and resolve against incredible adversity. He understands, as he said, in order to win this war and protect the American people, as they have been protected for the last 6 years, you have to go after these terrorists wherever they are and the states that support them.
Thank you, Daniel. Mark in McHenry, Illinois. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, and good morning, Mr. DeLay. Following up on the comment I just, the questioner that preceded me, and based on some comments I heard from Charlie Rangel this week, I'm just wondering when Congress is going to be reinstituting the draft or taking a vote on that so that the children of congressmen and contractors and the neocons and all the others that seem to be interested in this war without end are going to have to carry the same burden.
Well, all those people do have children that are in the military that are fighting in Iraq and other places. So that comment has no bearing on people and families and soldiers that are defending American citizens by fighting this war. There's not going to be a draft. First of all, the president wouldn't sign it. That's all political posturing. It could never get through the Senate. So that's just politics, as usual, coming from the Democrats.
Our guest is Tom DeLay. We're talking about his political career in Washington and what he thinks ought to be done to save the conservative movement, and talking about what he writes in his new book, No Retreat, No Surrender, One American's Fight. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Tom DeLay, author of No Retreat, No Surrender, One American's Fight. And Tom DeLay, I wonder what you think about this feud going on right now between Congress and President Bush over this supplemental spending bill that provides money for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also has a timetable to withdraw troops from Iraq. And the president says he's going to veto that. And the Senate says that he will be to blame then, not the Democratic-controlled Congress, if the troops don't get the money they need.
Well, first of all, the president doesn't pass legislation. The Congress does. And if they drag it out through political posturing, it is their fault that the soldiers are not getting the funds that they need. And this is another way of undermining the war on terror by... You can undermine it by just not passing spending bills in order to pay for the president. You don't have to have a bill that removes funding. You just don't have to fund. And I think that's playing a part here. I think this bill is absolutely outrageous. It was a war bill, a bill supporting our troops, and the Democrats, knowing that it would never become law, is playing politics with the lives of our soldiers, and I think it's outrageous. The only good thing I can say about it is at least they're upfront and public about their efforts. They were not public when they undermined the war in Vietnam. They were not public when they undermined our fighting communists in Central America. But at least right now they're upfront and public about wanting to surrender. And they're upfront, and I wish they'd just be honest and have backbones and vote their conscience to withdraw funds from our troops. That's mm-hmm. their ultimate goal, so why not vote for it?
Well, we understand that Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is saying that that would be the next step.
Well, I hope it is, because, number one, I don't think he has the votes to pass it. But it puts everybody on record exactly where you stand, and the American people can make a decision as to where their representatives stand, and we can move on.
Yeah, the Democrats, and you know, I think some Republicans too, not as many, but are saying that they are legislating here the will of the people. This is what the people want. This is why the Democrats were elected in November, is to get the troops home from Iraq.
At least they think that, but it is a representative government, and the president was also elected by the people, and he's doing what he thinks is right, and the Republicans are elected by a group of people, and they're doing what they think is right. The process is working. I'm not criticizing the process other than the fact that it is very dangerous to play games with the lives of our soldiers. They ought to vote and get it over with as to where everybody stands and move on. Either defund the troops or fund the troops and move on. Playing games and dragging it out and undermining their troops' ability to get training and equipment and all this other stuff that they need to protect their lives and do their mission, I think is pretty outrageous.
I got an email from Robin in Shorewood who says, replacing the current income tax with a sales tax is one idea that I could get behind. Can you talk more about it and tell us if there's any support in Washington for actually doing this?
Yeah, I lay it out in my book in great detail. Our tax code is a 20th century tax code that has been manipulated and I mean, there's a lot of social engineering in it. It's whoever's politically powerful gets certain advantages and not advantages, and it is seriously inhibiting our ability to compete in the global economy. And we are in a global economy, and we are certainly competing directly with the massive populations of China and India, who, by the way, don't tax exports coming out of China and India, which puts our people, our manufacturers, at a competitive disadvantage. We shouldn't be using the tax code to pick winners and losers. I call for eliminating all federal taxes, getting rid of them and replacing them with a sales tax, a consumption tax that taxes consumption, not income. It's very difficult to create any winners or losers or certain advantages for one person or another. The consumer decides how much taxes they pay by what they buy, and this will increase our economy by leaps and bounds. It will give us an unbelievable advantage in the global economy because exporters wouldn't be paying sales tax, and we could compete. It would have a great impact on our economy. It would impact our families, and it would impact our standing in the world. So, to me, it makes a lot of sense to have this 21st century tax code called a sales tax.
Tom in Sabisky is with us now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good Friday, Mr. DeLay. Good talking to you. My question is you talked about social welfare. I want to switch the subject to corporate welfare. I agree with your tax program that you talked about, but how are we going to handle the corporations in the sense of getting all the money, like subsidies and stuff for farmers, peanut farmers, corporations, tax breaks for bringing a business in? Can we also kind of make the level the field level across the United States so that every state has the same opportunity to get the same industry? Or, you know, so there isn't competition from the government level and free money to set up an industry?
Well, yeah, I'm with you. I guess I'm with you. I'm not sure I understand your question. I think what you're saying is all these government subsidies create competitive disadvantages between states and industries in different states. You're absolutely right, and that's what I'm talking about. If you get rid of all these subsidies and you institute a national sales tax, you get rid of all federal taxes and institute a sales tax, you're not picking winners and losers. The market then decides who's the winners and losers, and when you rely on and have confidence in the market, America always wins. And I just think that's the way we ought to go. It is revolutionary. A lot of people sort of put it off as saying it'll never happen. But everywhere I go, the American people want the fair tax, or they want a flat tax. I'm not a flat taxer because the income tax we have today was a flat tax when it was first instituted, and look what they did with it. And no, I want to get rid of income taxes and replace it with a fair tax.
Thanks, Tom. Gene in Madison is with us. Hi, Gene.
Yes. Representative DeLay, I must say that you certainly were not the Republican of my youth. Republicans used to believe in balanced budgets. And when wars were fought, they were paid for. This is the first war that the United States has been in which taxes were reduced. That means the national credit card is getting closer and closer to the max, and that will weaken our defense. You can make an argument that our policies have failed in Iraq because we refused to have the Republican gumption of saying we're going to fight a war and we're going to pay for it. And this happened on the Bush watch. This was not the Republican Party of the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. What happened? Why did you allow us to go to war and refuse to pay for it?
Well, I appreciate the question, and you have your point of view. I just disagree with it. We are paying for it. The tax cuts have brought in overwhelming increases in revenue to the government. If you look at the figures, the deficit is going down while we're fighting the war, which is pretty amazing. We have never fought a war and not have deficits. Wars are expensive. We understand that, and it drives up deficits. This Republican majority actually balanced the budget for the first time since the 30s in the 90s by cutting taxes and restraining spending. Spending as a percent of GDP went from 22% when the Democrats were in control to 18.5% when the Republicans were in control of the purse strings. Yes, we went to war, the deficit, and we had a recession, and the deficit started climbing again. But now it's on the decline, and it's if we continue these policies, not the policies of the Democrats, you will have a balanced budget again in less than 5 years.
Yeah, we'll leave it there. We're out of time. I thank you so very much for spending time with
thank
us and talking
Joy.
With
it's
our
great
colleagues.
Being with you.
Tom DeLay, author of No Retreat, No Surrender, One American's Fight. Since leaving Congress in 2006, Tom DeLay has launched the Grassroots Action and Information Network, as well as a political blog. You can read more about what he has to say these days, TomDeLay.com. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program. Thanks to Karen Prager for on-air production. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. The Week in Review, in fact. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.